Gonna rock the shade. Gonna scream my name. Make you shout now, honey. Gonna make you shout.
Whether you're an independent artist or a fan that loves them, makingascene.org is the place for you. For the music fan, we bring you in-depth interviews and CD reviews from artists who are on the cutting edge of original music. For the independent artist, we bring you articles on music business, recording techniques, gear reviews, and interviews with industry professionals that give you real-world information to help you negotiate the new realities in the music industry and give you the tools you need to move your career to the next level. We bring you new content every day. MakingAScene.org is the number one resource for the independent artists and the fans that love them. Head on over and become part of the indie revolution.
Gonna rock the shade. Gonna scream my name. Make you shout now, honey. Gonna make.
And now, here is an indie blues double shot from our featured artist today, Alistair Green. And stay tuned for that interview. It comes up right after these songs.
Lies and fear. Come on down to the mission. All you spread.
And that was Alistair Green from his brand new release. And we got Alistair on the line. Hey, Alistair, how you been?
I'm good, man. Thank you for having me back on the show. It's been a little bit.
Yeah, it's been a while since you've been on the show. We always like to get things rolling by giving our fans this opportunity to really get to know who you are as an artist. And you have such a rich history. So give us the story of Alistair Green.
Oh, man, the condensed version. I was born in Southern California and, you know, grew up listening to mom's record collection of the Beatles and Stevie Wonder and whatnot. And when I got into, like, junior high or so, I started kind of discovering my own music. So I got into, like, the hard rock of the time, Van Halen and Ozzy and stuff. And I grew up in Southern California, so close to the L.A. scene that was happening at the time. And I'd played musical instruments, you know, coming up, piano and saxophone, but I started playing guitar in high school when I was a freshman, and, you know, learning some of that stuff. And then when I turned, 17 or so, a friend of my dad's loaned me some blues records, some B.B. King, Johnny Winter, Steve Ray Vaughan, Buddy Guy, Allman Brothers, and that's when really things kind of coalesced for me as far as, like, really kind of realizing that a lot of the stuff that I was listening to, you know, had its roots in that music. And so, you know, you can trace, you know, a lot of these, you know, hard rock acts all the way back to, you know, Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and further back if you want. And so that's really kind of where I started focusing a lot of my attention as a guitar player and whatnot. And I was into a lot of other things. And so, you know, I just started playing a lot of guitar. I went to the Berklee College of Music for a couple of years out of high school on a scholarship, and then I came back to California and started playing in bands. And somewhere around 1998 or 99, I kind of formed my own sort of blues rock band as Power Trio. So my namesake band goes back to the late 90s, which is however many years ago now. And, you know, band members have changed a lot over the years, but the mission has stayed the same, which was basically to find a way to show appreciation for blues and the rich history that music has, and incorporating, you know, just what I, you know, come from as a rock and roll guy. So, you know, blues rock is the umbrella that you would find me under, I suppose. And along the way, you know, I've kind of, you know, done a bunch of sideman stuff that wasn't necessarily related to the blues. I played with Alan Parsons and the Alan Parsons Live project from 2010 to 2017. He was the engineer on Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, and then started a solo career in the mid-70s. And I've done a little bit with Starship featuring Mickey Thomas, who has some blues roots. He was in the Elvin Bishop Band and sang, you know, Fooled Around and Found Love, as well as all the hits from the 80s that Starship and Jefferson Starship were known for. And I also toured with Sugar Ray Rayford, I think 2018, for about a year. And so I, you know, doing my thing all along, but, you know, kind of had these forays into being a sideman, you know, here and there, playing a bunch of different kinds of music and traveling and touring. And in the last few years, I've been, you know, back focusing on my band. And, you know, I started making records 20-something years ago, and finally sort of unlocked the record deal key or record deal door, and, you know, I signed with Delta Groove in 2014 and put out a record with them, and I did a couple records with Ripcat, and then 2 or 3 years ago I signed with Tab Benoit's label, Whiskey Bayou Records, and we put out a record called The New World Blues in 2020 and toured that. And when we were in Chicago, we recorded some shows, and this is what my new record is. It's a live record from Chicago. It's called Live in the New World. It's songs off of the New World Blues, and Tab's on drums. Tab produced it and mixed it and helped write some of the songs that were on the studio record and whatnot, and his bass player Corey plays bass, and it's a lot of fun. It's actually kind of neat to listen to the studio record and then listen to the live versions that were recorded, you know, after the fact. And so that's why we're here. We're talking about the new record. Okay. I think that was a pretty condensed version of my history.
You kind of breezed right through that. Now, let's talk about, you know, putting out a live record. What was kind of the that mindset that you guys kind of, when you're sitting in the room saying, hey, let's do a live recording, what was that conversation?
Well, you know, honestly, there really wasn't. It was, we were going to Chicago, and I found out, you know, we did five nights in a row at the City Winery in Chicago, and I was opening for Tab on tour, and I opened for him, you know, since it's his label, and he's the guy that played drums on the studio record. It's a really cool thing. I open for him. He plays drums, you know, in my band, I guess you could say. Tab was the drummer in my band when I go on tour with him, and Corey played bass. And I didn't really know until we got there that they were going to be recording the shows. So I just made sure that, you know, I you know, played every night and mixed up the set list a little bit, so I had enough songs for the live record. There really wasn't much discussion about it. It was like, hey, they're recording these shows. Looks like we'll have a live record. And so, you know, when there was a break in his schedule, I went down and we mixed the record about a year ago. And so, yeah, I mean, it was kind of a spontaneous thing. It just sort of manifested out of nowhere. And next thing you know, I've got this cool live record. So,
cool. Now, let's talk a little bit about you as a songwriter, because that's one of the things that I think you're well known for. When you sit down to start that process, what really kind of gets the juices flowing and allows you to tap into the muse?
Well, a few things will happen. You know, sometimes I'll hear something and I'll start messing around on the guitar. I usually, it's interesting, when I know that I'm going to make a record and that I have to come up with material, I'll spend a couple of days just going back and listening to a lot of stuff that I love to get ideas. So, and that could range from, you know, like I meant, you know, some of the Chicago guys, you know, Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, or, you know, some blues rock guys. So I'll listen to some things and I'll just kind of get some ideas and some riffs and some, maybe some forms that I haven't done in the past. And I'll just kind of riffing around. And if there's things, you know, on the, that are going on in the world, I'll just maybe catch some phrases here and there for song titles, or you never know when you're going to find a song title. Something could happen in everyday life and someone says something and file it away for a song title. And so I lean very heavily, you know, on my blues influences, but also as someone that grew up listening to rock and roll, you know, I try to, depending upon the song, put a little bit of what I would refer to as like a chorus, you know, in some of these songs. And I, even from a very far, you know, the beginning of my, you know, getting into blues rock and wanting to be a blues rock artist, one of my missions was always really, I really want to take the feel and the vibe of all this blues music, but I also want to have some sort of a hook occasionally, have a chorus. You know, when you listen to like a Beatles song, it'll have a verse and a pre-chorus and a chorus, or it'll have a bridge. And while I don't do that on every single song, I like to throw that in there every once in a while, just because it's something I grew up with. I'm used to that sort of form of songwriting. You know, it's, I guess you could say it's a formula in a way as well. And so I kind of try and balance the two. I try and balance, you know, playing, you know, rock and blues, and really paying my respect to, you know, the guys that and gals that started that music. And then I also like to slip in some of my rock and roll influences, and you know, hopefully I come up with, you know, 10 or 12 songs that will sound good together on a record.
Okay. Now, you know, a lot of songwriters have embraced some of that technology that's out there today as tools in their toolkit, you know, the cell phone or a home recording studio. What are some of the tools you found to be indispensable to you as a writer?
I learned how to use Logic, which is one of the recording platforms that people have been using. It's a digital, you know, interface that, you know, you download to your computer. You know, a popular one was called Pro Tools, and I've done some records on Pro Tools, but I didn't really learn how to use it. And the last few records I did when I am in California before I signed with Tab's label, I did with a guy named Sean McHugh, and he runs Logic in the studio. And over the course of recording with him a couple times, I was like, man, this looks like I might be able to figure this out. So I downloaded it and learned how to use it, and it's you know, Apple-based. And so very quickly, I just learned how to demo songs, and it was really, and besides doing that, it's also helped me play on other people's records remotely. Like, I can play on people's records from my house, you know, because I've just, you know, I have a computer and the software that I know how to use. And that's really kind of one of my main tools when it comes to fleshing out a song, is demoing it, you know, every once in a while I'll have an idea and I'll get my phone and I'll go into the, you know, recording section and write, you know, write down a riff, or I'll open up my phone and write down some lyrics and stuff like that. But when it comes to actually demoing a song, I'll use Logic. And yeah, man, it's really helped me start, you know, getting things down on paper, so to speak, like being able to record and have the song kind of come to life in that way. And then you can give it to the guys that you're going to go record it, you know, in the studio with. And it's great. I can't say enough good things about being able to use a recording platform like that.
Nice. Now, of course, every songwriter gets to that point where they have to kind of allow the song to move from the writing phase into production. And I know, you know, you a lot of these songs you did for your studio album, now you're doing them live. And, you know, things always evolve. You know, they evolve when you get in the studio. And then when you take them on the road, they evolve even further. But you have to get to that point where you put the pen down and give it to the band and give it to the producer and allow them to kind of put their spin on it. How do you determine when a song is ready to move to that next phase?
That's a good question. Typically, if, you know, if I've got a riff and some chords and the lyrics and the melody, like I feel like it's ready to be thrown into the rehearsal room or into the recording studio. So, you know, that's typically when, you know, it depends on the songs. Like some songs I'll be a lot more particular about what I want to hear from the, you know, a rhythm section and whatnot. And then other times, I'll just give you an example. This last studio record that I did with Tab, written a handful of songs, but I knew going in, you know, how he wanted to do the record. He wanted to basically do everything almost live, you know, like we recorded a lot of the stuff live. He wanted to basically learn the song there and then record it. And so there wasn't a lot of rehearsal. It was really just getting those initial instincts and that initial inspiration of being in the room and like, hey, here's a song, and then recording it. And that's a great way of doing stuff. I've done things the other way where I demo something and be really particular about having people play certain parts in a certain way. But I knew I was going to benefit letting Tab and Corey kind of put their spin on things, because it was a unique thing for me to be able to record with guys that were from Louisiana. So they were just going to have a different way of playing and interpreting things. And that really, I wanted to be open to that experience. So that's really this last studio record, and even the line, you can hear it on the live record too, is very kind of improvisational, very spirited. You know, I would show and then we'd record it, and it was done. And you can do recording a bunch of different ways, and this was a Tab wanted to do it, and I really enjoyed it. I really liked the way that it came out. And on that same note, it's interesting to listen to the studio record where, you know, we literally just, I showed them the songs and we recorded them. And then I'd go back and maybe, you know, redo a vocal, or I'd, you know, maybe add a little acoustic guitar or maybe go fix a little bass thing. But it's pretty, you know, spontaneous. And then the line, listening to the live record, you know, we'd start playing the songs live, so they evolved a little bit. You know, they evolved some of the intros. We often, there's, you know, longer intros on some of them, or we jam a little bit more in the solo section, or, you know, the dynamics would be a little bit different. So, you know, music's a living, breathing thing, and it changes, you know, all the time once you start playing songs live. And you know, everything's just a snapshot. Anything that you listen to, a studio record or a live record, that's just a snapshot of a moment in time. And, you know, even now, you know, I'm in Austin now, and I've got some guys that are from here that are touring with me when I don't go for Tab. And so the songs continue to evolve and change and sound a little bit different, even depending on who's playing. But
okay. Now, let's talk a little bit, because I know this is a live album, but I'm always curious about how artists, you know, work in that environment of the studio, because that's another creative process in itself. You know, having a good song is half that battle. Creating its identity in the studio is a whole new world. What is your process when you get into a studio environment? What do you like to do to kind of get the sound you want?
Well, you know, it kind of depends on the studio itself. I've done things a bunch of different ways. you know, when I was recording in Southern California, last couple records I did with Sean McHugh, we were all in the same room. Well, it's actually the same with Tab, but we were all in the same room. And, you know, we had, you know, maybe an amp in the, you know, in another room mic'd up and stuff. And so we, you know, you'd wear a head, you just want to be able to hear everything well in the headphones and be able to kind of see everybody and be able to have eye contact. And for me, it's important to at least get the guitar sounding good. Anytime you listen to think through headphones, you know, you're losing a little bit of what it actually is going to sound like. So you just kind of want to stay inspired and get as good of a sound through headphones as you can. So that's kind of an important thing for me, and just having a good vibe in the room is really what, you know, what you want. You want everyone to kind of show up and be positive and open, and everyone be on their, you know, on their game. And it was the same with Tab. We were all in the same room in his studio, he and Corey and I, and you want to get, you know, your headphones sounding good, and then make sure everyone's in that good mood, and then get after it. You know, it's not, I mean, to me, it's, I've done it enough now where as soon as I feel like, okay, this is comfortable and, you know, I've got a guitar sound that I like and everyone's, you know, mic'd up and ready to go, it's like, well, let's just start making it happen and start making, you know, start making takes and see if we can get something that we can live with and move on. And when you're playing with guys that have done it before, you know, or have done it a lot, it usually can go pretty quickly. You know, if everyone knows the songs and knows their instrument, I haven't really run into a situation in a long, long time where, you know, it took more than two or three takes to get the music down. You know, I'll go back and fix stuff or I'll add things, but, you know, with this last studio record with Tab, I mean, you know, we got the drums and the guitars and most of the bass and, you know, cut just a couple of takes and then we pick the best take and move on, you know?
Okay. Now, of course, you're on Tab's label and you got the opportunity to work with Amy Bratt from Bratt Girl Media to kind of promote and get this out there. Tell me a little bit about that relationship.
Well, you know, Amy's got her own company, the Bratt Girl Media, and then she also works with different labels, you know, in different ways. And for the Bratt Girl Media, you know, so she works for, you know, Whiskey Bayou Records, you know, with some of the artists. And I've worked with her on my last several records. And so for this record, she's doing, you know, publicity, you know, interviews. She's, you know, set up this interview. She's doing press and radio, you know, so just she basically can do everything. She and you know, she does radio and press for other labels. She also does some social media for some labels and stuff like that. So she's pretty much covers all bases as far as all that kind of stuff goes. And she does a great job. You know, she's knows her stuff. She's got all the relationships with the magazines and the radio stations and all that kind of stuff. And she's done a great job for me for the last, you know, I want to say 4 or 5 records that I put out.
Okay. Now, you've been in the music industry for a good number of years, and you've seen some of the changes that have happened in the industry, especially as we entered into the digital revolution. And, you know, the elephant in the room here is the consumer has embraced streaming as a way to consume music. We're not going to change that. I mean, it's now there.
Right.
Vinyl ain't going to save our asses, you know, no matter what anyone tells you. Once the CD players disappear and you can't, like I said, you can't go to Best Buy and buy a CD player anymore. You can't buy a new car with a CD player. So we have to deal with what we have. And the problem that I'm seeing is that the consumer no longer looks at recorded music as a product to purchase anymore. It's now a service, something that they expect free on their phone. If you're not on these services, you're immediately discounted. You know, you're not relevant to the consumer. How has this shift in perception by the consumer affected you as an artist?
Well, it really means, you know, selling. You know, you have to sell merchandise at the shows. You know, I mean, music's kind of become, you know, I guess, like you said, it's sort of just the service that's streaming. I mean, some people will pay, you know, to download a record on iTunes, or, you know, people still buy CDs at shows, and, you know, part of it's maybe to have, a souvenir. A handful of people still have CD players. I started USB cards with me with some of my older records on them to sell at shows. It's very strange, you know. I mean, obviously, it's you're not making as much money off of physical media anymore, unless it's at a show. You're not making, you know, as much money off of, downloads and stuff because people can get it for free. People pay for a monthly subscription for Spotify, and they get everything for free. So it's, you know, the only way to really kind of make that money back after you record the record is to sell physical copies of it at shows, or just get, you know, tons and tons and tons of downloads. And, you know, there are ways that people, you know, I guess, you know, modify or whatever the word is, you know, with their YouTube channel or that and the other thing and whatnot. But yeah, to say it's unfortunate is just obvious, but it's like you said, there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, it is what it is at this point. And unless there's some sort of, you know, government regulations on what streaming platforms pay artists, I feel helpless at the level I'm at. I mean, it would take you know, all the Bruce Springsteens of the world, you know, going to Congress or something and demanding them to, you know, change how this works. But it is very strange. You know, I mean, I put out my first CD in, you know, 2000 or 2001. I released it independently. I released, you know, records independently for the first, you know, 10 or so years of my, you know, recording career. And I remember putting them up and seeing them being downloaded and getting like checks here and there. And, you know, even 20 years ago, I remember seeing the dip in sales as, you know, things went, you know, digital. You know, you'd send, there's a company called CD Baby. I don't know if you remember them, but they were a great distributor for independent artists. And I've still got a couple releases that they've got some, you know, records of that they helped facilitate getting you on iTunes and getting on, you know, that now they get people on streaming services and stuff. But originally, you know, you'd send them physical copies of your CD and then they'd, you know, sell it online. And it was kind of before Amazon. So you'd have a website and you'd have a link to CD Baby per se. And so they'd ask, you know, whenever you'd sell stuff, they'd go, oh, you know, send us 5 more CDs, send us 10 more CDs, because, you know, you're selling them and they're distributing them through their channels. And I remember just even the first, you know, few years that I was putting out records, that physical copies went down drastically, you know, through, you know, CD Baby started, you know, saying, you know, if you're a new artist signing up for services to only send them a couple of copies to sell. Yeah, you know, one, because their, you know, their warehouse was getting full of, you know, more and more artists. You know, I mean, that's the thing, is there's more and more artists creating more and more product, you know. And so, you know, at this point, it's just an oversaturation also, you know. But that's another conversation maybe. But, yeah, I mean, it's what are you going to do? I mean, you have to go out and play. I mean, the only real way to make, you know, money off of your recorded music and stuff is to go out and play. I mean, there are people that sit home and record on their phones and go on TikTok and Instagram and they're able to modify it. But that's not why I started playing music, to sit in front of my phone and, you know, get followers, you know, playing cover songs or whatever it is on, you know, social media. I started playing guitar so I could go play shows and record my songs, you know. That's just, I'm not making a judgment call. If people want to sit in front of their phone and record stuff and put it up on Instagram and whatnot, that's great. But that's, you know, that's not why I started playing guitar. I played guitar to play shows and write songs and make records.
Right, right. Well, you know, if you kind of look at streaming, you know, with the amount of monies that are being distributed to the artists, and then you look at the industry as a whole, there was this article in Billboard where it stated that only 12% of all the income that's generated by the music industry actually gets back to the artist. And that's a really bad statistic. It has to really change. We have to change that dynamic. Because, you know, the amount of monies that streaming provides the artist is not a sustainable business model. You can't continue to ask artists to go into studios, pay for musicians and producers and engineers and studio time and all of that is involved with PR and so on and so forth, and not at least give them the opportunity to break even. So we need something to kind of change that dynamic, to kind of give the artist the opportunity to make more income off of their work. Do you see anything coming in the future that could possibly change that?
I don't. I mean, right now, that my focus, is on, continuing to write and record the shows. But as far as like what could change, I mean, it would take some sort of, it would take changing some laws on I mean, do you remember, I don't know how long ago it was, where there was the big Napster lawsuit. I think Metallica sued Napster or whatever it was, because it was a file sharing service.
Right.
And, I mean, I don't know how long ago that was now. And I remember that being kind of like the first time I was like, wow, this is weird. Like, there's these ways that people are sharing music for free. And, back in the old days, someone would buy a record and you'd borrow their record and you'd make a cassette copy of the record. So like that, is a primitive way of, so you paid however much for a record, then you loan it to your friend and then they make a copy for free. And so I get, that this has been happening on some level for a long time. People have been, or you did that too, or you make a mixtape, or you do this and the other. So, like, the playlist is just a, the Spotify playlist is just a glorified mixtape, or mix, CD thing. But as far as changing that now, man, I don't know. I mean, it would take some sort of legal, some laws being put into effect to change, how people are able to, get music. But what the Napster thing showed us, I think, is that there's ways that people are going to work around that if they really want to, So,
I mean, there's always going to be someone out there who has the ability to steal the intellectual property of a musician. I mean, it's out there. Even if you record it off the radio or you record it off a podcast or whatever the case may be. But, it's interesting that you mentioned Napster, because that was kind of the beginnings of that whole digital revolution that we're in now.
Because
when Napster was out there, and when, I think it was Metallica that, or who was it?
Metallica that sued Napster for, whatever
right.
it was.
Well, everyone said, you can't stop Napster. It's too big. It's too widespread. You're never going to stop it. And then along comes Apple, and they have iTunes and they have the iPod, the iPod, and of course everyone's getting 99-cent downloads, and Napster seemed to have fallen by the wayside. And then all of a sudden Spotify comes along, and the idea is that it constantly changes. The technology changes, the consumer moves and flows within the industry to these new technologies as they come out. And I'm watching some new stuff that's happening, one of which is the streaming services that are being developed that utilize the blockchain, which is that software technology that secures cryptocurrency. And the whole idea of that is to decentralize the music industry. In other words, take away all these distributors and aggregators. And, every time you put out a record, there's six people in line with their hands out looking for a piece of that. It's to get rid of that and give you a direct fan-to-artist connection. And they're claiming that they can pay artists up to 80% of the incoming revenue. There's sites like Audius, which are up and running right now, that are backed by Katy Perry, Jason Derulo, Pusha T. Then there's Emanate, and there's Audio Locks, which is due to launch, I think, in the next 30 days or so. So there is technology coming down the pike that could give us the ability to at least have the chance to break even on a recorded project, or at least make some money.
Now, right.
There is this other side of this technology too, where artists are actually selling pieces of their songs to their fan base, utilizing this NFT technology, which is also based on the blockchain. There's a site called royal.io that allows you to kind of create these NFTs that represent either a small percentage of your streaming royalties or a small percentage of, let's say, your publishing royalties of a song. One of the rap artists did this, Naz. He took two songs out of his current release, and he made enough of these NFTs to cover one half of the streaming royalties on each of these two songs, and he sold it to his fan base and was able to generate almost $600,000 in upfront income. And now these things can be traded on the open market. They're bought and sold. So if someone decides to sell their percentage of one of his songs, he gets a commission off of that in perpetuity. So this is another way where there is a direct fan-artist relationship that allows the fans to actually become investors in a song they like or in an artist they like.
Yeah, I think that'd be cool for the fans. I mean, the fans aren't going to make any money off of it. It's more of a the fans feeling like they're part of something, you know, because the NFT thing, I had a conversation about this recently. I mean, the NFT thing's really, I mean, it's there's nothing tangible. You're not actually buying or investing in anything tangible. It's just kind of to say that you've got, if you really have to be a big fan of something to invest in an NFT, because there isn't really anything. It's I don't think they would go up in value. I mean, that's at least the conversation I have was like, well, there's not really anything to go up in value. It's just, you're just a fan of something, and it's just nice to have a piece of it, you know, or whatever it is.
You definitely, well, if you're buying a piece of royalty on a song, I mean, that's a tangible product. In fact, Joe Bonamassa did one where you got a unique song that he recorded that's not available anywhere else. And in addition, the purchaser of that NFT got a vintage Les Paul from his collection.
Oh, interesting.
So, I mean, the NFT itself is more of a representation or a certificate of authenticity of the product that is attached to it.
Right.
So, you know, it's just like a stock certificate. A stock certificate alone is not a tangible item, but it represents a tangible item. It represents your ownership of a percentage of that company. So, you know, I see this as a potential future where the industry is not controlled by large corporations and record companies, but more a direct artist-fan relationship that is, fostered through, artists branding themselves and getting their fan base to engage. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think you'd have to be a sizable enough artist for that to really have an effect. I mean, the advantages of, the streaming thing is you do get your music out there and you are able to reach a lot of people. But, you know, like you said, there's not like a big revenue stream there. But in order to get a revenue stream from what you're talking about, NFTs, you have to have that fan base to begin with for it to really make, make a difference in your financial life. You know what I mean? Kind of like of course, like Bonamassa is going to make money off of that, or, a rap artist or something like that. But I think, for blues artists, or blues rock artists or anyone kind of below a certain, popularity line, that stuff is or isn't going to have as much of an effect as it would on, somebody like you mentioned that sold royalties for a song and made $600,000. I don't think that's going to happen for the independent or, blues rock artist, unless they're like you said, like Joe Bonamassa or something like that.
Now, one of the things I've seen especially when the pandemic hit, is a lot of artists went on the internet and they started doing live streams and creating content. And as we continued with that, it got to be like 3 years, these artists started to get really sophisticated in utilizing social media and utilizing content to kind of give their fans almost a reality show kind of feel by giving them access to their world and kind of feeding them kind of branding information to kind of get them invested in the artist. What are some of the things that you're using in, you know, in social media and content that's helping you promote your brand and getting your product out?
Well, you know, during the first, you know, whatever year or so of the lockdown, if you want to say, you know, March, whenever that was, March, what was it, 2020? You know, I invested a little bit in a service that helped me broadcast live. I bought a camera for my computer, and I would broadcast. I had something called Throwdown Thursday. So every Thursday, I'd go online and do like an hour show. I'd play some music. I'd talk about music. I'd, you know, we even got into, like, you know, talking about food. I mean, I kind of had just a hour-long show on Thursdays, and I had a virtual tip jar, and that was a way that I could kind of stay connected with the fans and play some music. And it was a good outlet. You know, I have, you know, once I was able to go back out on tour, I went back out on the road and started doing shows in April 2021. Yeah, I went and did a tour with my friend Orphan John. I went out and toured Tab. I started touring my band. So once that started, I, you know, kind of let the online performances go. But as far as social media goes, you know, I make videos to promote shows. You know, you can, you know, I'm on all the different platforms. I have a Twitter, I have an Instagram, I have a Facebook, I have a TikTok, I've got a YouTube channel. And so, you know, I kind of go to all those and, you know, kind of circulate my content. I'll make videos or graphics. You know, you can, you know, make little videos with music and stuff like that and whatnot. And so it's, you know, it's just kind of part of how you promote now. You know, a lot of the platforms like Facebook or Instagram, if you want to, you know, reach more people, they ask that you pay. So you have to, you know, kind of figure out what your budget's going to be to promote on social media. And so if I'm playing in, you know, St. Louis on a Friday, I'll make a video talking about the venue that I'm playing and where you can find tickets and stuff. And then you'll, you know, put it on your Facebook page, and then you go in and you sponsor the ad. You kind of pick the demographic that you want it to appeal to, and then, you know, the city that you want it to, you know, be targeted towards. So, you know, I mean, it's still, you know, an investment, but it's cool because it's not, you know, in the old days, I mean, you know, I'm old enough to have, you know, put up flyers, you know, if my band was playing in LA, we'd drive down to LA and have a staple and then a bunch of, you know, flyers and, you know, staple them up on, you know, we didn't do that a ton on telephone poles or, you know, so, I mean, I, you know, come from that, or you'd, you know, call newspapers or you'd, you know, send stuff out. So the way that you promote has changed. I mean, the newspapers obviously still exist, but so many things are online now that, you know, the print thing, you know, with the exception of a handful of magazines and newspapers, you know, a lot of stuff's just online, and because it's online, you know, that's another way that the online outlets, you know, the social media outlets or whatever, you know, they, you know, kind of charge you to, if you really want to try and promote something. And so that's kind of how, you know, I mean, I, you know, I'm fairly active on social media. I, you know, do a lot of my, you know, do my own posts and a lot of my own graphics and videos and stuff like that. And it's just kind of part of being an artist now. Until you can truly afford to pay someone to do everything for you, you know, you do it yourself, DIY, man.
Yeah, tell me about it. You know, I really appreciate you coming on the show.
It's, well, man, thanks for having me. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, man. Always good talking to you.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, we're going to give everyone out there an Indie Blues double shot from your new release. You guys are going to love this. Just turn it up loud. You know what? Screw those guys.
Thank you. Gonna rock the shade. Gonna scream my name. Make you shout now, honey. Gonna make you shout.
Whether you're an independent artist or a fan that loves them, makingascene.org is the place for you. For the music fan, we bring you in-depth interviews and CD reviews from artists who are on the cutting edge of original music. For the independent artist, we bring you articles on music business, recording techniques, gear reviews, and interviews with industry professionals that give you real-world information to help you negotiate the new realities in the music industry and give you the tools you need to move your career to the next level. We bring you new content every day. MakingAScene.org is the number one resource for the independent artists and the fans that love them. Head on over and become part of the indie revolution.
Gonna scream my name. Make you shout now, honey.